A college student on the road back to school. What should have been a straight shot drive across Highway 80 in 1993 turned into a nightmare that would torment a family to this day. What happened when Tammy Jo Zwicky's car broke down? Where did she go? Who did she go with? And what happened to Tammy Jo Zwicky? That's today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Today's episode of Dark Side of Wikipedia starts with an original People article from 1993 about Tammy Jo Zwicky. Statistics and crime reporting tell us much about the murder in the U.S. We know that on average, 20,000 Americans are killed every year, and we often learn how they were murdered and why. Far less visible, however, are the repercussions of those homicides, the pain that victims' families and friends must live with in the months and years afterwards. This is a story of one such crime, the killing of a 21-year-old college student on or shortly after last August 23rd, and how it challenged and changed the lives of her family, classmates, and community over the following 12 months. Sunday, August 23rd. With Evanston III behind her, Tammy Jo Zwicky headed west around Chicago towards I-80. Three more hours of driving in the hot afternoon and she'd be back in Grinnell College in Grinnell, Iowa for the first time in 8 months. In art history and Spanish double major, she had studied in Spanish during the spring semester of her junior year, then spent the summer living at home with her parents and working at a video store in Malton, New Jersey. Classes didn't start for 2 weeks, but Tammy, a photographer who worked on the Cyclone, the school yearbook, planned to arrive early to take pictures of Grinnell athletes who were already training for the fall season. Then the student everyone called Z was to begin a one-semester art study program in Chicago. As a photographer, she was just starting to blossom, says sports information consultant Jim George. She had smarts, talents, and a bright, bubbly spirit that could charm the biggest, meanest football player into cracking at least a little smile. The day before, Tammy and her youngest brother, Darren, 19, then a Northwestern University sophomore, had driven her on-air-conditioned Pontiac 1000 hatchback for 9 hours, starting near Pittsburgh, where their parents were visiting relatives and arriving at Darren's school in Evanston's that evening. The next morning, Tammy continued alone. The car stalled a few times, Darren remembers. The engine would just de-accelerate. The oil light would flicker, and then you pull over, the engine would shut off, and after 2 stalls, I added oil and water, and it ran fine. The morning before Tammy left, I checked everything and told her that if it seemed to be doing that again, just stop somewhere. Went until the evening when it was cooler, like a rest area. Those are the last words of advice Darren would ever offer his sister. At 5:05 p.m. that Sunday, about 4 hours after she had said goodbye to her brother, an Illinois State Police officer spotted a white 1985 Pontiac parked on the westbound shoulder of I-80, 5 miles east of LaSalle. Located next to a mile marker 83, the locked car was lagged and abandoned as a vehicle. Not until 2 p.m. the next day, Monday, would it be towed away, and not until 7 p.m. would its owner be identified. Monday, August 24th, back home in New Jersey, the Zwickys had expected Tammy to make her usual check-in call when she arrived in Grinnell. When she didn't telephone on Sunday evening, neither parents were overly concerned. We thought she probably met up with friends, and it got too late to call, said Joanne. But by Monday morning, when they didn't hear, they began to worry. But then we knew something was wrong, Hank said. It just wasn't like her not to check in with us. Joanne repeatedly called Tammy's friends at Grinnell, but they hadn't seen her. Z, someone had scrawled at the message board outside her dorm room. Where have you been? Your mom's having a cow. A civil engineer with the construction giant Floor Daniel in Malton Hank Zwicky, then 52, had always kept a close watch on his children's activities, especially Tammy's. Much of his caution, he says, stemmed from fears brought by the accidental death 17 years before of his 7-year-old niece, Tammy's cousin, who was struck by a falling tree limb when crossing a creek. It was more lax with the boys, but not with Tammy, Hank says. She was very responsible, but I'm still worried about things. Her being out late, driving, going to parties, whatever. Joanne, a 50-year-old former secretary, now a homemaker, usually fretted less about her daughter's activities. In Greenville, South Carolina, where the family lived until Hank was transferred to New Jersey last year, Joanne treated her children's friends with an all-welcoming enthusiasm. Everybody just hung out at the Zwicky's house, said Trin Glover, a high school friend of Tammy's. Her mom always had the snacks and soda. She was so cool. Now both parents were worried. Joanne asked Grinnell Police to look for Tammy's car, then began calling Iowa and Illinois State Police. It was only after her daughter's hatchback had been towed and a description logged on computers that the Zwickys learned of its location. Hank immediately filed a missing persons report with the Illinois Police, describing Tammy as a 5'2", 120-pound blonde with green eyes and long blonde hair. Later, he added that she was probably wearing a tortoise shell, wire-rimmed glasses, and had her hair in a ponytail, and last seen by her brother. He's wearing a white t-shirt, dark shorts, gray running shoes, a fabric friendship necklace, and a green watch that played "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head." She was carrying about $150 in cash, credit cards, and a leather handbag, extra clothes, and a box and several cameras. Tuesday, August 25th, I tried to tell my boss what had happened, Hank recalls, but I was so agitated I couldn't concentrate. When Hank stammered out of his plan to drive to Illinois, his manager took charge and arranged to have Zwicky's flown to Chicago. Hank's colleagues volunteered to house sit, take care of the couple's two cats, and answer the phone in case Tammy called home for help. I can't see her going with someone or hitchhiking, Joanne said before leaving New Jersey. It'd have to be by force. Wednesday, August 26, while most of the country's attention focused on the devastation wrought by Hurricane Andrew 2 days before, which limited media coverage of Tammy's case, mailing to the Midwest, scores of students at Grinnell and other schools volunteered to help find her. The next 6 days, they fanned out across the region, posting and handing out hundreds of missing persons flyers with Tammy's pictures at truck stops, convenience stores, and airports. At Grinnell, they held the first of two candlelight vigils for Tammy. Even if you didn't know her, you pitched in, one volunteer said, echoing a general sentiment among female students. I could have been Tammy. We're all vulnerable. In Illinois, state police scoured the I-80 site where the car was found using metal detectors, search dogs, and a helicopter. The car, which started up without a problem after being towed, was checked for fingerprints and searched for evidence. Tammy's leather bag, money, credit cards, and a Canon EOS camera were missing. Meanwhile, at the Chicago home of friends, the Zwickys continued to make emotional public pleas, hoping news reports might produce leads. By now, Hank and Joanne had been joined by their sons, Dean, 25, a computer science graduate student at Johns Hopkins University, Todd, 26, a University of Virginia law student, and Darren, who had been the last to see his sister. Tammy, if you see this, just hang on, Todd said before TV cameras, his voice breaking. We're coming for you, added Dean. If someone's holding her, they're not going to be able to get far. Putting up with three brothers all the time, she can handle herself pretty well. On Monday, August 31st, investigators announced they were looking for a white five-axle semi-tractor trailer with two brownish diagonal stripes on both the tractor and trailer. Drive-by witnesses reported seeing the truck and its driver near mile marker 83 on I-180 on August 23rd. Roughly between 3 and 4 p.m. The man described as white, about 6 feet tall, with bushy dark hair, appeared to be taking a young blonde woman resembling Tammy. The two were standing by her car, apparently checking something under the hood. He's the last person we know who may have talked to her, said Lieutenant Howard Brendango with the Illinois State Police Station in LaSalle. He's not a suspect. We just want to talk to him. Volunteers now help the Zwickys fax revised flyers to trucking groups and about 40,000 trucking firms nationwide. Students at Grinnell and other campuses also rushed out to post their new flyers at highway stops, sounding hopeful Todd remarked, Tammy has incredibly good judgment. She wouldn't get into a car without a stranger. Joanne, stressing Tammy's street smarts, added that her daughter was a strong-willed, tough cookie who had worked in many jobs and traveled on her own in Spain. On Tuesday, September 1st, 9 days after Tammy disappeared, hot tub installer Lonnie DeMont, 37, was driving his pickup truck on I-44 near Joplin, Missouri, some 500 miles southwest of LaSalle. It started to rain, and Lamont, concerned that his tools at the back of his truck were getting wet, pulled to the side of the highway at Circoxy exit. I was finished and was coming around to the front of the truck when I smelled the odor, says DeMont. I looked right and saw a blanket in the grass. Just from the shape of it, I could tell it was a body. DeMont drove to a nearby highway patrol station, then returned to the scene with an officer. They made a small cut in the blanket and saw a human leg. The body, which is lying face up on a grassy slope about 14 feet from the pavement, had been wrapped tightly in a white twin-size sheet and a dull red blanket. Silver duct tape closed on both ends. By the afternoon, Lawrence County Coroner Don Lankin had performed the first examination of the shoeless, badly decomposed body. It appeared to be a white female, Lankin reported, approximately 60 to 24 years of age. She was clothed in a blue T-shirt with Eastside Eagles Soccer 1989 printed in white lettering on the front. Also had a pair of faded blue cutoff sweatpants, athletic socks. 7 puncture wounds made by a sharp instrument, no more than a half inch wide, were found in the upper chest area. The weapon had penetrated her lungs, liver, and cranial sac around the heart. The victim's right biceps was also punctured, possibly due to a struggle. Eddie. Discoloration appeared on the right side of her neck. Poor little thing, Lankin said. Looked like she'd been there under the sun for a good 4 to 5 days. A pathologist later estimated how long the body had lain there by the type of insects removed from the soft tissue areas. The odd part was she didn't appear to have any blood, just some body fluids on the sheet blanket from the decomposition. Despite the similarities, the body was not immediately identified as Tammy's. It's unbelievable how many girls fit the body's description, says Lankin. After this hit the news, I got calls from all over the U.S. from people thinking it was their daughter. It's obviously the dark side of Wikipedia from what you're listening to. If you like our program, please support us over on Patreon, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Get the final chapter of this episode and all of our episodes, and you also get advanced episodes of the show to help keep this show on the air so we can help continue to tell these stories. Without your support, we don't exist. So that's what that goes towards. Tony and Carol with you on today's episode. So uplifting and happy thus far.
I know. It's like such an incredibly sad story. And at the very end of that segment,
yeah,
when you said that families from all over the country thought it was their daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, that got me.
I know. That's the really...
That's the reality.
Yeah.
You know?
Ugh. I can't imagine. I honestly, as a dad of girls, It's your worst nightmare, and I cannot.
Well, and then
I
her cannot, dad. Yeah,
I cannot remotely process how that would go. How I would deal with that. I don't know that I could deal with that. Quite honestly, mm-hmm. I mean, it would just. Mm-hmm. I'm such an anxious person on fucking normal shit. My fucking daughter's missing or something. I don't. You'd have to have me medicated and like really held back because I don't know what the fuck I'd do.
Because they talked in the beginning of that about the dad was so overprotective of her, yeah, because of a niece that had died,
yeah,
in a freak accident.
Sure.
And then that's almost like a sense of he knew or something.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Oh, I couldn't. That's just.
It's the most probably protective I'll ever feel of anyone in my life ever is of my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I just cannot. I mean, it's so fearful just even like trying to put yourself in these situations and these mindsets. You kind of do it, try and understand, but it's just such a oh my God, you just want to throw up. Even just
you can't go too far there, because man, that's real life for people.
And I don't know how you stay sane. I don't know how you stay sane going through it, like going conscious and like, here, can I give you this information? Can I help you do this or that? It would just be so, I think, mentally taxing on someone, especially a sensitive person, that it would just, I don't know. I don't know how the fuck someone deals with that. And I never, ever, ever want to be in that situation. But it's, I just feel so horrible for these parents where they're in those states. Because, like, what the fuck do you do?
I don't know. I really don't know how you deal with all that.
Yeah. And especially, too, like, when, I mean, if you're in that state for a long time, and then they finally do find, like, a answer, it's like, oh, it's this guy. We got him. As I've said before, it would be very hard not to find some way to sneak in there and get close to that person on a visitation and kill them.
No, I get that.
Like, I'm Joe Bob. I'm her uncle or his uncle. And I'm just here to give support. Okay, let's get him in there. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I'd find some fucking way to fucking do something. Because I don't think I'd let the justice system play out, quite honestly. If I knew, if it was questionable, no. But if you just, all the evidence was there, it's like, this fucker did this. I'm sorry. I'm like, I'm going to jail for the rest of my life, but I'm going to fucking shiv you in the fucking jail first. Mm-hmm. And then you can do whatever the fuck you want to me. But I don't think I could, because I don't think I could, like, live a life after that. You know, being like, oh yeah, she died and he's in jail and I'm just going to move on and go to Hawaii. I don't think I could, like, fucking live. I think the only thing that would satisfy me is, like, he's dead. Oh, cool.
Yeah, and those people who are like, well, and then we forgave him. I'd be like, I think that all the time.
Can't do it.
Like, if it was something horrific, I'm like, maybe if you did, like, keep it to yourself. I just don't know that I'd want them to know.
I don't think I could.
But maybe that's missing the point of forgiveness, actually.
If you're not there, it's hard to say, but I'm just, like, from the distance, I'm like, I don't know how the fuck I could do it.
Right.
Like, I'm such a justice-oriented person. I'm like, no, you're going to fucking die. And if I have to go to jail for the rest of my life for killing you, that's cool. You fucking do it.
And then how random that truck driver pulled over right where he did.
Yeah. But, I mean, the thing is, I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're going to learn more about this. I don't know anything about the truck driver yet. But
I don't think that's suspicious at all. No, I think that was like one of those deals where somebody ends up in the right place at the right time or wrong at the, you know, and he's, depending on how you look at it.
And the fact that he's like going to the police going, you got to come look at this guy. He's like, this isn't right.
Right.
I think it exonerates him.
And if nothing else, he brought that family what they needed. Yeah. I mean, you just hear those stories where the bodies are never found.
Yeah.
I don't know how you live with that.
I know.
That question. All the time. Like, what happened? I don't know.
Yeah.
That would be even harder than knowing.
I never would have understood this until I had a daughter, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you read these stories and I mean, then you understand, like, what that love is for your daughter. And it's like nothing else. And it's like, it's a part of you. And there's just, you know, you can't contemplate this sort of shit happening. And if it does, it's like, someone's going to fucking pay. And that's it. Like, that's my new life motive. You know, I'd rather just, like, make a nice garden and have a good life, but you fucking do that, I'm sorry, that's my new life motive is killing you. And
I get it.
It's just fucking horrible. But let's continue on as we enter into Wednesday, September 2nd. I believe we're in 1993 at the time. If you'd like to remember what happened in 1993, Bodyguard soundtrack came out. Mariah Carey's Dream Lover CD was popular at the moment. Beavis and Butthead were on MTV. That was 1993. So let's go back there. Wednesday, September 2nd, while the Zwickys waited for a detailed Missouri medical examiner's report, they tried to remain hopeful. The victim's clothes were not the same as those Tammy wore. when her brother, Darren, last saw her in the dead woman's underwear, lacy panties, and a frilly, flesh-colored bra with the word love embroidered between the cups was no means the sort of lingerie Tammy wore. But other evidence was foreboding. The t-shirt was from Tammy's soccer, learned at Eastside High School in Taylor, South Carolina. Also, several patches of the cutoffs were from two other teams she had played for. Rarely, Joanne, now back in Moulton, told reporters from the porch of her two-story, four-bedroom home, "We didn't want to talk about it anymore. We're trying to be as calm as we can." On Thursday, September 3rd, local police called the family to relay the news. A definite ID based on matching dental records confirmed that Tammy was the murder victim, although it was uncertain whether she was killed on August 23rd or several days later. "Losing your kid is every parent's worst nightmare," said Bonnie Yablosky, Joanne's sister and mother of the seven-year-old niece who had died. "We're made of strong Polish stock. I just told Joanne, hang in there. If you let yourself fall apart, the criminal hasn't only taken your life, but two or more." Thursday, September 8th, Zwickis attended Mass at the Catholic Church in West Newton Beach, Pennsylvania, where they were married 28 years ago. Nearby on the rain-sodden slope of the West Newton Memorial Cemetery, Tammy's body was being lowered into her grave. "We thought it was best not to see her buried," Hanks explains. "Same reason we had a closed casket at the funeral home. I didn't think we could take being left with those images." Originally from the hilly coal mining area of South Pittsburgh, the couple also felt that Tammy, born in neighboring Pleasant Hill, was coming full circle back to her roots. By the time Tammy was buried, the hunt for her killer had sparked nationwide interest, especially after America's Most Wanted heir to spot announced on her disappearance. That prompted a flood of tips about the truck with the diagonal stripes and a logo no one seemed to remember. As her death involved an abduction across state lines, FBI agents joined the 14 Illinois State Police investigators working with Missouri authorities on the case. At the beginning of the investigation, the Zwickis had criticized the police for treating Tammy's disappearance initially as though she were a runaway. Now authorities stressed their strong interest in the case. "A lot of us have college-age daughters," said Lieutenant Belongo, "so we have a personal reason for wanting to catch the killer." In the following weeks, more than 60 drive-by witnesses reported having seen Tammy on August 23rd. Altogether, they claimed to have seen 26 different vehicles, including cars, motorcycles, and vans that stopped to help her, with men and women at different times apparently offering her assistance. "It's incredible," Joanne said. "All those people saw her or talked to her, and not one of them had a cellular phone they could pick up to get her some help." Remarkably, none of the people who stopped has ever come forward to notify police of their encounter with Tammy. "Can't explain it," FBI agent Bob Long says, "except that maybe these people still don't know about the case or they're afraid to get involved." However, some leads did place Tammy elsewhere in the hours and days following her disappearance. A motel clerk in Mendota, 15 miles north of LaSalle, for example, said a lone young woman resembling Tammy appeared at the motel and asked about room rates. The girl said she was driving to her college in Iowa when her car broke down on I-80. And now a trucker outside was giving her a lift to Wisconsin to visit a boyfriend. Though police believe the clerk's sincerity, she passed two polygraph tests. They were unable to come up with a Wisconsin boyfriend, nor could anyone corroborate a clerk's story. "Another dead end, like a thousand others," said Lieutenant Berdonglo. "It's frustrating." By the end of the month, the three Zwickis' sons had returned to their schools, and Hank went back to his job, relieved to immerse himself in work again. He and Joanne had appeared on AM Philadelphia and the Oprah Winfrey Show when focused on highway murders of women. As though it was emotionally to talk about, Joanne said after Oprah, "We decided on lots of exposure to keep Tammy's story alive." Hank added that they wanted to help take back America's highways, and expressing the frustration at the slow pace of the investigation, he said, "I just want them to find a person who killed her daughter. If they don't catch her, that son of a bitch, I don't want to know what I'll do." Thursday, October 15th, Joanne was speaking almost daily by phone with her sister, Bonnie, at a home near Pittsburgh. Bonnie would console and listen, trying to shoulder some of Joanne's pain. Having lost her daughter in the creek accident years ago, Bonnie knew the first months would be the toughest to bear. "Life goes on," Bonnie would tell her. get through it in one day at a time until it doesn't hurt as much, then too carefully went on. Over the case, anything new, promising leads, press interviews, offers to help by psychics and private investigators, Joanne kept a log of names, numbers, and notes relevant to the case. She called it my Bible. Zwicky's home was filled with Tammy reminders, hundreds of condolence cards, pictures of her in every room, her paintings, her art class, and her cats. 11-year-old tabby called Zorro and a blind gray tabby named Bob. Upstairs, Tammy's small room was cluttered with picture albums, family photos, dozens of Garfield pictures, a life-size inflatable Gumby, a James Dean poster, soccer shoes, and a pair of Birkenstock sandals. It's hard, but I'm about to... The only person who comes into the room, Joanne said. Many of the mementos were from Tammy's high school years at Eastside, a LOP student. She'd been the photo editor of the era irregular yearbook her senior year. Started school at city soccer teams and was known to be level-headed and independent. Tammy had a mind of her own and wasn't influenced by those around her, recalls Marion Rice, a Spanish teacher. Joan Ullinger, a school friend, remembers the time Tammy surprised an obnoxious boy who was pestering them. "We were walking in a hallway," she says, "and this guy wouldn't leave us alone. So Tammy turned around and decked him. He never bothered us again." Hank, home from work for lunch, sat in the living room beneath the framed collage of Tammy's portraits. A reporter had arrived asking about the latest news in the case. Hank grimly mentioned that the family had finally received an autopsy report, but kept to himself to confirm that she had been sexually assaulted. As he spoke, he methodically popped the pea-sized bubbles of the sheet of plastic insulation, pressing hard with his thumbs and fingers. "There's always those people that tend to feel sorry for the criminal," Hank said flatly. "I don't think I could forgive the person. I think I could be one to execute him." On November 8th, the afternoon when Hank turned off I-80 at the Ginnell exit, he began to cry. He was overpowering reactions that he hadn't expected. The college had invited him and Joanne back to meet with the students to discuss a scholarship fund in Tammy's name. The school was a big part of her life, Hank explains, adding that he had last visited the campus in December of 1991 to pick up Tammy before sending her off to Spain. A lot of memories came back. Several hours later, more than 200 students squeezed into the foyer and sitting room of the campus guest house to visit the Zwickys. Afterward, Jason Paschal, a junior from Omaha, who briefly dated Tammy before her trip to Spain, said, "Until they came, we were reeling. Tammy's death really hit everyone hard. But I think the Zwickys were so strong that we fed on that strength." The couple also spoke with the local private detective who had volunteered his services. Former Griddle Police Chief Jim Ahearns planned to investigate trucking companies and their routes. He and the police believed the likely killer was a trucker because Tammy's body was found at a sufficient distance down an on-ramp to have been dumped from the back of a truck. Ahearns also believed that the murder may be responsible for other unsolved cases in the region. "I want nothing to do with a reward," Ahearns said, referring to the just-announced offer of $100,000 by an anonymous Pennsylvania donor to anyone with a tip that would help arrest the convicted murderer. "I just want to catch the guy. I believe he's still out there. I think he's going to do it again." Before she went to Spain, Tammy had spent 2.5 years on the Grinnell campus. If she didn't know everyone, at least they knew her, usually by her camera, long blonde hair and tomboyish exuberance. "You don't intimidate, Z," said senior Mark Patson. She had her own quirky way of everything. She ate cheeseburgers for breakfast, power napped in the afternoon, hated dresses, loved Tom Petty and James Dean, and liked to party as much as the next student. Tammy's father knew these things. Before he left Grinnell, he learned something else about his daughter. He was talking with Patton, who mentioned the annual Grinzel Waltz, the school's annual ball. "A bunch of us would all go together," Mark said, noticing tears welling up in Hank's eyes. "Could my daughter dance?" Hank asked, realizing that Hank had probably never had the chance to see Tammy dance. Mark answered softly, "Yeah, she could dance." On Friday, November 27th, the morning after Thanksgiving, came as a welcome relief. Yesterday had been rough, as Joanne put it. She set out a turkey with all the fixings. Hank and the boys seemed to eat well, and everyone tried to stay upbeat and cooperative. Still, Tammy's absence left a big hole in the fill during the family's first holiday get-together. A candle was lit in her memory, and the talk about Tammy was open and direct. "We don't shy away from talking about her," Joanne explained. "We're also not big of religious people. We just work things out. Hank and I have our times, but we don't give up. I've had pretty bad nights, or sometimes I'll forget to make dinner. Hank will hold things in, and the boys, they seem to handling it." In the living room, Darren played with a Game Boy. Dean worked with a jigsaw puzzle, and Todd was telling a visitor how close they were to Tammy. "Just one of the guys," he said. "She thrived on jokes and gags, like when we were kids. We'd be sitting in the back of the car, and one of us would say, 'So, Tammy, I'm getting hungry. Would you like to get some lunch?' And she'd say, 'Yeah, I want a sandwich.' And we'd squeeze together and smash the person between us." Later, Darren and Joanne said, "Was having the hardest time working through Tammy's death," spoke. "Sometimes I'll be watching TV and the topic or situation triggers it. I'll just usually leave her, whatever. It's day to day. I can handle it. I'm fine with that." Christmas, Bonnie suggested that Joanne not do anything special for the day. "Just go with the flow," she said. "Do what feels natural. Don't push. Good advice. Since all the holidays, Christmas was Tammy's special time since childhood. Sheila would choose and usually decorate the tree. This year, Hank picked it out, bringing back a ceiling scraper that no one decorated with any enthusiasm. They tossed a few things on the branches, and the new centerpiece ornament was too heavy for the top. The white and pink porcelain angel was placed in the front window instead. Another ornament was found spotted in the tree. A little book hung from a gold string. "It's about an angel and how an angel gets its wings," Joanne said. Tammy's favorite movie, Todd recalled, was the Jimmy Stewart classic It's a Wonderful Life, in which the angel Clarence earns his wings by doing a good deed. For years, Hank and Tammy had talked about getting a bird for the house, but never quite got around to it. The day before Christmas, the Dean's investigation, the boys purchased a crested male cockatiel, put it in a cage, and gave it to their father when the family opened the presents. Hank chuckled, "But you can't keep it caged," he said, opening the wire door to let it out. "A bird's got to fly free. Now how about it? I name it Tammy." The suggestion was greeted with silence as the cockatiel flew around the room, and someone suggested Ed, after the Ed Grimley character from Saturday Night Live. Hank agreed and was soon happily coaxing Ed to perch on his shoulder. On March 12, 1993, Joanne had struggled through the hard winter. "These were the worst months. They were hell," she told a friend. Despite regular calls from her sons and others, being home alone became a daily trial. Tammy's cat Zorro died in early February, which left Joanne the company of the blind cat, Bob, and a bird. The link came to Hank. "My salvation was having two little girls up the street that could hug any. I could hug any time, and I needed a lift," Joanne said. "They were just two and three, and we got quite attached. Their mom and I would have tea. I got the hugging I needed. Today, the day before what would have been Tammy's 22nd birthday, Joanne woke up apprehensive but feeling strong. In several hours, she would present her first talk to a class of criminology students at Stockton State College in Pomona, New Jersey. The speech was part of a new activist reaction to her daughter's death. Leads in the case had dwindled, and the Illinois investigation team had been scaled back from 14 to 2. Moreover, Joanna tired of badgering police for information. "So, I decided to share my story with others," Joanne said. "We have to make something good come of this. I just can't let Tammy go this way." At the college, Joanne stood before 50 or so students at Demure. A matronly figure with long brown hair and an earnest expression, she was nervous. She wanted this talk, sponsored by the South Jersey Survivors of Violent Crimes, to have an impact, to make people aware of highway homicides in America, a prevention, and the role of police. The family lived in South Carolina. Joanne spent most of her days with young people, usually as a volunteer mother at a high school function. She never had a problem talking to students, but this was different. She was on a mission, one that would soon blossom into her other talks, other support group visits. "Let me start by telling you a little bit about Tammy," Joanne began. "She'd have been 22 tomorrow, but she's not here to celebrate her birthday." Joanne paused, a choke in her voice. Then she caught her breath and continued, "This time, she did not falter. On May 1st, this morning, Hank and Joanne looked at granite samples from two gravestone shops in West Newton. By the time they walked to the slope towards Tammy's burial site, they had chosen a dark gray headstone with a Garfield next to a simple inscription of her name and the dates of her birth and death. As he had in the past, Hank continued to feel he was somehow partly responsible for his daughter's fate, for raising her to be cautious with strangers. Maybe she had been more of a free spirit, he said, while strolling between the headstones. She'd taken the first ride and got through the whole thing without a problem. That's what's so frustrating. They're prostitutes and other kinds of women in crazy situations, and they're still alive. There's a kid like Tammy, someone you protected, nurtured, and guided. She worked hard, went to school on a scholarship, did all the right things, and someone takes her life. It's unfair, totally wrong. People talk about Cod and how he's controlling things. Why did he let this happen? During the small stone chapel by the exit, Hank gazed back up at the green slope, tree-lined and dotted with hundreds of polished sentimentals. I can see her, he said. We visit Grinnell. Sometimes we'd see across the lawn by her dorm. She'd come running over, the Embraer shorts, ponytail flying, waving her arms, with a big old grin on her face. Hank recalled that he had survived a house fire, accidents, marital problems, you know, arguments, good times, your bad times, job problems, but nothing as bad as this, he said. Sure helps keep everything else in perspective. Some stuff just isn't as important as before. I learned to take it in stride. In Ames, Iowa, psychic Sue Walker, on the 22nd of May, closed her eyes, leaned back in her living room recliner, and asked for a few minutes of silence. Background seashore sounds wafted from a stereo speaker as Hank and Joanne waited for Walker to drop down into a trance. They were mildly skeptical of a clairvoyant. They paid Walker a brief visit while spending graduation weekend in Grinnell. We don't believe or disbelieve, Joanne said. We just want to see if she can help. Next hour, Walker held a snapshot of Tammy and answered questions from Hank. As the session progressed, she gave a description of the killer. Slender build, 32 to 40. Years old, high forehead, slightly bulging brown eyes, longish hair, Caucasian. She also saw Tammy in a truck cab. She had a red blanket in the sleeper compartment. The raping and stabbing, even the farmhouse that hid the truck. Did she know we were looking for her, Hank asked? Yes, Walker said. She watched you in her spirit form when you were before the TV cameras. Later, driving to Grinnell for a senior's bachelorette and commencement exercises, Hank expressed disbelief in Walker's visions. Most of the details, even the sexual assault, were publicly known or could have been imagined, but Joanne was more helpful. You never know, she said. Psychics themselves say it's a hit or miss. I'm willing to give them a chance. On May 24th, while rain clouds threatened to disrupt Grinnell's outdoor graduation ceremony, Hank roamed to the video camera, taping students and speakers. Joanne, meanwhile, sat on a folding chair, clutching her program, which honored Tammy as a member of the class of 1993. After the presentation of degrees, Hank and Joanne walked away from the crowd to speak to a TV reporter who asked why they were attending the graduation. Well, we need to close a chapter in our lives, Hank said. And then Tammy's not here, so we're here in her place. Joanne, noting the sun's rays spiking through the clouds, corrected them. Oh, she's here. She made sure it wasn't going to rain. On July 4th, Hank and the boys playfully lined themselves up on the Atlantic City boardwalk and stepped out into a synchronized strut. Tammy would have started the whole thing, Joanne said. Watching from a distance, she got her playfulness from her father. I guess he's starting to be his old self again. Leaving the boardwalk, the family, along with Dean's and Todd's girlfriends, clowned among some exposed pilings along the beach. It's coming on a year, Joanne said. Still no results in the investigation. But what can I do? I have no faith in the FBI or police. In particular, she's concerned about a recent loss of possible evidence. Witnesses at a gas station nearby where Tammy was found had reported seeing a trucker that might be linked to Tammy's case, yet police, who initially said that they had collected receipts from the filling station, never did, and the slips were eventually thrown away. Master Sergeant Harold Hendrickson of the Illinois State Police said the oversight occurred because they were simply stretched too thin. So yeah, a lot to unpack there as we continue. And I'll let you unleash your thoughts as I've been talking for 20 minutes.
I don't know. It just gets so wrapped up in that story. And, you know, because here's a family that lost a child, and then somehow you have zero information about where what happened to your child.
Yeah.
And you have to figure out how to go on. And I know there's so many families that deal with that sort of thing. I just can't wrap my brain around it. I think that would be, because it would just eat you up all the time. Especially the one brother, like, what if I would have done this? What if we would have, what if I knew her car wasn't running well? What if, you know, would just eat you up.
Sure.
And how do you, you know, even get out of bed? Because, yeah. I mean, the last thing you want to do is go on.
Exactly.
I'm highly impressed by the family, though, you know, trying to still have Christmas, even though it would be miserably difficult, but trying to somehow go forward.
I don't know how you do it. Yeah.
It's a very sad story. It's so sad.
It is. It's horrible.
And, you know, she sounds like this amazing person. And I know sometimes, you know, anytime you lose someone, then you tend to remember them.
Yeah.
Like they were kind of a saint, whether they were or not. But she just does sound like someone that everybody loved.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know. I just hope there's some closure coming up in this story. That's what
too.
I'm hoping.
I do too.
Because I don't like it when I'm watching one of those shows on TV, on Discovery, you know, ID, and then I find out it's one of those that they never did know, like, oh, I'm watching Disappeared. Oh, man. And because that would be the worst thing to not ever know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feels so bad.
No, there's so many just horrible stories you hear. Like, how the hell do you handle this? How do you go through that, you know?
Especially you want to talk about it. Like, I get being in front of the media or going on Oprah or any of that. I get that because you'd want to get that story out to as many people as you possibly could because somebody somewhere knows something.
Yeah.
And if you can find that one person somehow.
Yeah.
You know, but every time you do that, you relive it.
I know.
That would just be so hard.
I know. We got our final chapter of this story. There is a final chapter. We'll go into it. If you want to hear it, become a Darksider. Sign up at patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. Go to our website, darksideofwiki.com, and click Become a Darksider. Get access to this final chapter and all of our final chapters, as well as advanced episodes of the show. That's what supports our program and keeps us on the air. So if you like the Dark Side of Wikipedia, you've been listening to it for a while, this is the way to support it and keep it on the air. patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia. We greatly appreciate the support. Without it, we would not be able to keep going on. So please do that. If you like the show, give you all those extras. And as a big thank you. All right. We'll see you over there on the dark side. Carol and myself, patreon.com/darksideofwikipedia.